Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
In 1968, the idea of protesting changed forever. The experience became more personal, more visceral, and the perfect example of that progression is Resurrection City, a shantytown constructed on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., and inhabited by poor Americans for 6 weeks. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. In the months following the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., people of all races, from all corners of the country, converged to stand behind a common goal. It marked the shift from the fight for civil rights to the fight for human rights, and Resurrection City, with its tiny weathered houses barely sheltering men, women, and children from all over the United States, sent a clear message. These people wanted America to know what poverty and what their lives look like. Allison Keyes has an article in the current issue of Smithsonian Magazine called "Deeply Grieving MLK's Death, Activists Shaped a Campaign of Hurt and Hope." And she joins us now to talk about it. Allison, welcome to Think.
Hey, Courtney. Thanks for having me.
So tell us about the Poor People's Campaign. When was it conceived and what was it all about?
Well, actually, King had been thinking about economic justice pretty much throughout his career. According to the founding director of the National Museum of African American History and Culture, he thinks that people forget that just as involved as he was in fighting for civil rights, he was involved in economic justice. If you remember, in 1963, the March on Washington was a march for jobs and freedom. So in December of 1967, he and other organizers, including Marion Wright Edelman, Reverend Ralph Abernathy, got together and thought, okay, we're going to put together this campaign, we're going to bring it to the steps of the powerful in the nation, and we're going to tell them they have to do something about poverty in this nation. But the important thing was they wanted this to be multicultural. They wanted it to transcend race because, as they put it, the problems of poor whites, the problems of Mexicans, the problems of Latinos, the problems of blacks, all dealt with the same kind of thing. People didn't have any money. They lived in the richest nation in the world, and they felt that lawmakers ought to do something about it.
And it had a pretty specific platform, from what I understand. What was the Poor People's Campaign, you know, kind of tangibly fighting for?
Well, they wanted $30 billion in annual appropriation for a real war on poverty. They wanted Congress to pass legislation that would create a guaranteed annual wage, and they wanted the construction of 500,000 low-cost housing units per year until the slums were eliminated. Their first phase was going to be the shantytown that they built on the National Mall. Next phase was going to be public demonstrations, mass nonviolent civil disobedience, and mass arrest, and then they were going to launch a nationwide boycott of major industries and shopping areas to get business leaders to get on board. They also put out an economic bill of rights on Solidarity Day, which was right before the end of the campaign, that wanted the federal government to recommit to the Full Employment Act of 1946, legislate the immediate creation of at least 1 million socially useful career jobs in the public service, adopt the pending Housing and Urban Development Act of 1968, extend to all farm workers the right guaranteed under the National Labor Relations Act to organize agricultural labor unions, and restore budget cuts for bilingual education, Head Start, summer jobs. You know, they wanted a lot, but mostly they wanted the nation to see, here is poverty. Here's what's happening for people that aren't you. Here's what's happening for those of you who aren't senators or a lobbyist or anything like that. These are regular people that came from all over the country. There was actually a caravan of wagons drawn by mules that brought people from Marks, Mississippi to Memphis, Tennessee for Dr. King's memorial service and then on to Washington, D.C. It was a huge mobilization of people from all over, and everyone wasn't sure it was going to work really well at first.
And was that intentional, the idea of the caravan of wagons pulled by mules? Was that because there needed to be drama and visibility, and it couldn't just be people showing up out of thin air? They wanted to see them coming?
They actually had a plan for 9 regional caravans, and yes, obviously that was kind of an optic. There was an Eastern caravan, there were people from the Appalachia Trail, the Southern caravan, the Midwest caravan, the Indian Trail, the Freedom Train, the Western Caravan, San Francisco. They wanted people to come from all over the country to let the nation know that this was affecting people in every race, in the mountains, in the valleys, in the Midwest, on the farms. They wanted people to understand what a widespread problem poverty was and continues to be.
And it's interesting, as you ran through kind of the ideas of the platform, I'm sure the numbers would be very different if we converted this to today, but it didn't sound all that unfamiliar from what you hear a lot of activist groups and nonprofits and people who work in the community and public sector demanding today. I mean, did that strike you when you were doing research for this and preparing for the article and the exhibit we'll talk about later at the Smithsonian that doesn't seem that far off from what we're discussing right now?
No, actually, it doesn't seem that far off. And what was interesting, the day they did the preview of the exhibition, it was really cool to be in the room with so many venerable civil rights activists. And there were young people there as well who wanted to know, okay, so poverty looks different now, right, than it did in 1968. As one of the curators pointed out, when you had a blue-collar job then, if you were an auto worker or something like that, families lived in houses. Families could buy houses. They sent their children to college. But poverty now is different. If you have a minimum wage job, you can't afford to buy anything in most cities, much less in Washington, D.C. You can't send your kids to college. And a lot of families are now headed by single mothers, right? So you don't have the same mechanism to move forward. So their problem is, all right, we have this president in office now that doesn't appear, in their view, to be doing anything to help us. They're only doing economic things. But back in 68, there were also social programs. There was Head Start. You know, there was a lot more welfare. There were more programs to help people avoid poverty. But now, instead of doing it both ways, they're thinking only economic things. But the current budget doesn't include a lot of those social programs and, in fact, cut a lot of them. So people are very concerned.
Let's harken back a bit to the time after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. Obviously, there was profound grief. What were those first few weeks like for those in the civil rights community, also just citizens who really identified with what he was fighting for?
Well, I think, as you know, there was urban unrest in a lot of cities around the country, including Chicago, because people took his death very hard. There were concerns that his movement wouldn't continue, and Marion Wright Edelman and others were determined to make this happen. So he was assassinated on April 4th. By April 29th, they decided to launch the caravan anyway and bring them to Washington. So they had 9 caravans that were coming. They had already worked out a lot of the principles that they were fighting for, and they decided that they were going to make this basically his last human rights campaign. Even though he was gone, it was still being done in his name.
So despite the fact that there was no real hesitation about moving forward, does it surprise you how quickly they mobilized?
No, I don't think so, because these were people that had been doing that for years, right? I mean, back before the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, they had already been going to cities all over the South, fighting for civil rights and fighting for economic justice. So these people had broken hearts between the Vietnam War and the protests that were going on over that, the murder of Dr. King, the murder of Robert Kennedy. So there was a lot of pain and uncertainty, but I think they came together and in a kind of a campaign of hope, right? They had pain, but they still had hope to get their message heard. And actually, a lot of the activists that spoke at the press conference that day talked about that. They said it was really hard to continue, but they remained focused because Dr. King would have wanted them to remain focused, and that's what they intended to do.
Your piece for Smithsonian Magazine focuses on a photographer who was in Washington, D.C. to document the Poor People's Campaign. His name was Robert Houston. Let's listen to a clip of him talking about what life was like in the wake of MLK's death.
The day after I got word that Dr. King had died, I grabbed my camera and I hit the streets of Boston and I started taking pictures. And I saw vandalism, all of that kind of stuff. And I said, no, I don't want to do that. I'm not going to do that. It serves no good end. I have to do something positive. I had no other choice.
So as Robert Houston said, one of the positive things he did was grab his camera. And he had a really memorable experience photographing the Poor People's Campaign, right?
He was actually lovely to speak to. I mean, he's this little old man who still takes pictures, you know, in his spare time. But he was surrounded by this whole group of admirers who just couldn't believe some of the images that he captured. But he got here a couple of days before Resurrection City was actually built. And he said at first he didn't know what to expect, but one of the first things that he saw was a group of teenage boys who were holding a newspaper upside down and asked him if he could read so that he could read it to them. And he said he didn't know what to think about that. Then he saw a white man who basically threw up his hand and said, you know, good morning, brother. And he said it was exciting and scary because he didn't expect such friendliness from someone white. And he said, wow, I don't know how this is going to go. I don't know what's going to happen. Then there was an incident in front of the Department of Justice where there were people protesting and there were police officers on both sides of the street. And a man who wasn't part of the protest walked up and threw up a fist and said, you know, basically black is beautiful. And the cops rushed in, he said, and pushed him to the ground. And he was taking pictures of it. So four police officers started walking toward him. But he heard people murmuring behind him and turned around. And there were hundreds of people that were saying, tell our story. We've got your back. He said it really blew him away. He had no idea that it was going to be this level or that level of support. So he was very happy to be part of it.
So a lot of his photos appear in the Smithsonian Magazine piece. Can you describe a few of your favorites?
Wow. I think one of my favorites is the one where there's a, and I forget the name of the musician, that's a close-up of him. He's playing the guitar, and it's kind of an upshot. So you can see his face, and you can see from whatever he's singing, and I don't know the song that he's singing, but there's a pride there. There's a hope there. I want these people to feel like this is a part of the community, because one of the things they did in Resurrection City was use music to help create a sense of a community, because it was a city. I mean, it was an actual city. It was so large, it had its own zip code. You know, there were tents, there were schools, you know, there were daycare centers. It was really quite something. So to look at images from there and think what those people were thinking, right? You know, because there's another image that of a young man sitting inside of one of the tents by himself. And you wonder, now, where did he come from and how did he get here? He's dirty because it's just started to rain around then. So it's a little muddy because, you know, there was a great deal of mud and rain during the Resurrection City. But you wonder what made it important enough for him to find however he got to get to Washington, D.C., to sit on that mall and try and send this message.
So Resurrection City was not like a bunch of professional protesters or folks that did this regularly. You can see these photos of entire families inside the tents. I mean, people really Yes. did put their lives on hold and come to live there.
Yes, they absolutely did. As I said, there were schools. I mean, and it was a little messy. And some people left after the first couple of days because they said it was too uncomfortable. It was hot because D.C. is not fun in the summer, you know. But they said they wanted to show their commitment to this fight, and they hoped the federal government would listen. Celebrities came through, some lawmakers came through to see what was going on. The mayor of Washington, D.C. came through. And the thing was, one of the curators talks about how the government actually made this possible because they gave them the permits to be on the National Mall between the Lincoln Memorial and the Washington Monument, which you might not have expected them to do. Mm-hmm. And they had an agreement that they could stay until June 23rd. So they did have a lot of help from the Department of Justice, the National Park Service. They did have federal help in trying to get this message out. But it wasn't an easy place to be. I mean, you know, there are no clean bathrooms or anything like that. So some people did stay with other families and in hotels and that kind of thing. Some of the higher profile civil rights activists did. But the regular people were right there on the mall in the dirt showing that they believe. One of the interesting things that the curator said to me was that people today get on Twitter and they get on Facebook and they call themselves activists, but how many of them would actually have gotten on a bus or in a mule train or in their cars or however they got here and come to live in the street under the sky and let people know what they're thinking?
And they also had to contend with kind of serious flooding at one point, right?
Yeah, there was. They said it was almost like a biblical flood. There were days and days of rain. So it was filthy. It was a mess. And I think a lot of people wanted to leave during that time, but it was right around the middle of the campaign. In fact, part of the exhibition, there are three cells of video surveillance footage from the U.S. Signal Corps. And in the first cell, it's right early in the campaign, so you can still see green grass. There's grass under the feet. The town is still pretty neat. By the second footage, though, it's all brown and muddy. It looks like rivers are running through the whole middle of everything. So every step you took was in the middle of mud. Every step you took was a mess, but people stayed because they wanted to make sure that people knew they were poor and they wanted the government to do something about it.
Our guest this hour is Allison Keyes. Her piece for Smithsonian Magazine is called Deeply Grieving MLK's Death, Activist-Shaped Campaign of Hurt and Hope. Join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372. We'll be right back.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
We are here because we feel a frightful sense of urgency to rectify the long-standing evils and injustices in our society: racism, poverty, and war. The Poor People's Campaign was conceived by my late husband, Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., as America's last chance to solve these problems nonviolently.
That was Coretta Scott King, activist and wife of the late Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., speaking at Resurrection City in 1968. I'm Courtney Collins in today for Chris Boyd. You're listening to Think, and we're talking about that movement in 1968, the Poor People's Campaign, and the launch of Resurrection City, which the idea was to bring a lot of visibility to poverty in America. Our guest this hour is Allison Keyes, who wrote a piece on this for Smithsonian Magazine. Allison, what she said about nonviolence was really crucial to this whole campaign, right? Everything had to be about nonviolent public civil disobedience.
Absolutely. And it's very interesting that you played that particular cut, because there is a new group of activists that have launched a new version of the Poor People's Campaign, and they actually have the exact same core principles: racism, poverty, war economy, militarism, ecological destruction. But one of their things is also violence of any sort will not be tolerated. They're going to do a huge demonstration, I believe, on Mother's Day, and they've been doing things all over the country. They want many of the same things, except part of the issue for them is moral revival. They say moral revival is necessary to save the heart and soul of the economy. They want to lift up and deepen the leadership of those most affected by systemic racism, poverty, the war economy, and ecological devastation. And they want to see the dismantling of unjust criminalization systems that exploit poor communities and communities of color. So it's really interesting that it's basically the same thing. It's 50 years later, and it's no better.
What's interesting to me, do you think the way the original Poor People's Campaign was presented and how unique the idea of Resurrection City was, did that pave the way for the moral revival? Without it being done the way it was back then, 50 years ago, would we have all this grassroots activism today that seems spurred on in the last few years?
I think maybe we would, because particularly over the last few years, things have gotten so much worse for poor people, right? Since 1968, the number of Americans below the official poverty line has increased by 60% to 40.6 million. And poverty rates are higher for African Americans and Latinos, obviously. But white people make up the largest number of the country's poor. The Reverend Dr. William Barber is one of the people spearheading the new movement. And he has been crusading across the country for voting rights, against economic injustice, against the criminal system that has locked up so many people of color. These are things that people have been fighting for years, and they really haven't stopped fighting. It's just that the fight has changed a little bit. There are now more people on social media, but it's not the same thing as getting out into the streets and marching. It's not the same thing as standing in the mud in front of the Capitol. Sure, you're on Facebook and you're saying great things and you've got a million followers, but what does that mean? If you're not actually doing anything, if you're not getting people out to show what they're thinking, right? It's all on paper. So I don't think I'm surprised that this is being done in this way. I think that they're trying to make it an important issue now, partly because so many people of color and so many human rights activists have complained about President Trump and his policies. They've complained about the policies that are coming out of Washington, D.C., and they're trying to find another way to make their voices heard in 2018.
Let's take a call now. The number to join the conversation is 800-933-5372. We're going to hear from Joy in Dallas. Joy, go ahead with your question.
Hi, it's Joyce, and I'm an activist from the 60s. Desegregated schools, who has desegregated neighborhoods across the country, who has desegregated the largest Episcopal church now, desegregated veterans. I bring in young people and I introduce them to what the programs are now that replace federal programs. Lots of it's free. You go to the library, you insist, you persist, you get with the librarian, and then your life give a state, not just a day where you're marching.
That's an interesting concept, the concept of what has replaced government programs, things like nonprofit organizations in that sector. What do you think about that, Allison?
I'm not sure that everybody, first of all, knows about those resources because, I mean, there's the internet, of course, but not everybody has access to that, right? And some young people haven't been taught that history in the schools now, so they don't know what to do. They're looking at Facebook, they're looking at Twitter, but I'm not sure that a lot of them know where to go to get that information, Joyce.
That's an interesting question to ponder. Do you see, and I know you're a journalist, so it's not like you can give great recommendations editorially here, but I mean, what do you think is most important for young people who consider themselves very civically engaged today? How can they kind of harken back to the time of 1968 when people were engaged in a completely different way than they are now? What would be something to do to kind of get you there mentally?
Well, one of the things that Peter Edelman said, he's Marion Wright Edelman's husband, he's an activist and lawyer, he said that one thing is that we need to mobilize in a way. We need to stop just talking about poverty and find ways to fix it. He says, you know, whether it's Social Security, whether it's SNAP food stamps, whether it's earned income tax credit housing vouchers, you know, there are twice as many people in poverty now. And we need to fight back. He says there are millions of people that are poor. They're not the same good jobs that were there after World War II into the 1970s because the country is no longer industrial in the way that it was. So those blue-collar jobs we were talking about earlier don't exist. He says we need to end mass incarceration. We need to improve our education. We need to have affordable housing. There's a long list of things that need to be done, and jobs is at the heart of it. So maybe one thing that young people could do, and I'm not suggesting that they particularly get involved with this campaign, but there are a lot of organizations all over the place, from Black Lives Matter to the ACLU, in which they might be able to go and volunteer. The NAACP is still doing things. The National Urban League is still doing things. So perhaps what you do is go to the brick and mortar places of these organizations and stand there and go, okay, hey, I'm standing here. What can I do?
Talk to me a little bit, we touched on this earlier, about how time was passed in Resurrection City. So this was a six-week process that people were here. It had a start and an end date, but no, they weren't just sitting there passing the time. There was a lot going on inside of Resurrection City that kind of reinforced the demonstrated concepts. What were they doing?
Well, some of them were reading, some of them were giving speeches, some of them were teaching the children. You know, and some of them were strategizing about other ways to get their agenda accomplished. People went and sat in front of congressmen's houses, I mean, offices, I should say. People had meetings with lawmakers. People went to some of the lobbyists, and people also talked to the leaders of some of the organizations that helped organize this to try and find a way to keep the movement going after Resurrection City was over, because the whole point was supposed to be this was all going to change things, when sadly, obviously, it did not. But there was also a lot of music going on. There were concerts. Celebrities came and played. There were recordings in the exhibition of music that was being played there, sheet music and lyrics. So people got together and sang, you know, they did everything they possibly could to make themselves into an actual community. So you didn't feel so much like you had all of these different races from all over the place that were just in this weird place together. They wanted people to feel like they were connected and like this was an actual city where they were getting together to do something real.
So I assume there was some sort of like revolving stage for people to come in to give speeches. Was there a lot of momentum kind of throughout the 6 weeks? I mean, was the excitement and the tension there the whole time?
I think that the momentum ebbed and flowed because sometimes, as I said, there was a lot of bad weather. So that kind of dampened some of the enthusiasm. But I think the baseline energy from the interviews I did was there the whole time. There were people, as I said, that got discouraged and left. There were people that said, okay, I'm here for a couple of weeks and I'm out, you know. But I think the underlying force of hope that people had stayed there. Actually, Lonnie Bunch, the founding director of the Smithsonian Museum we were talking about, visited when he was 14 years old. And he was raised as a middle-class Black man, and he talked about how his mother was wearing yellow gloves and yellow shoes, and he couldn't believe that she was dressed up to walk through this settlement. But she took them there so that they would see what poverty was like. And he said the thing that struck him was that there were so many people there that were willing to sacrifice, I mean really sacrifice, to send out a message. And he said it stayed with him ever since.
And the campaign was truly multicultural. And you talked about this a bit in the first segment. But, you know, the whole idea that there was a big nonviolent movement where people of all races were unified in fighting poverty. Why was that such a significant shift from the protests and the demonstrations and movements that had come before?
Because I think a lot of the movements that were before, although Dr. King's movement was multicultural, it was still seen as a mostly black battle for civil rights, right? So you saw some white faces, but you didn't see the level of diversity that you saw at this campaign. There were Mexicans, there were Chicanos, there were Appalachian whites, you know, that all came together in the same place. There were people with calling Black Panthers the N-word, but they were still there working for the same goals. So I think it blew a lot of people's minds that once everyone got together and decided they weren't going to fight, that they could work together. And it transcended race because, you know, the issue was not race. The issue is that everyone was being touched by the pain of poverty, right? So you have to get past that and move on with your agenda, which is something that Dr. Bunch says he hopes this exhibition, it gets people to understand that that is a possible thing to do in this country.
And how is the camaraderie between the different racial groups? I mean, was there a good rapport, or were people mistrustful? Do people kind of divide up within Resurrection City based on race or geography or socioeconomic status? How did that work?
From what people told me at first, yes, there was a lot of mistrust because, as I said, there was a group of Black Panthers meeting with a group of white folks, and the white people kept using the N-word, and the Black Panthers were like, okay, we're not down for this. But then when they said, we're still here to fight for poverty, they said, okay, we're here to fight for the same thing. So I think at first it was a little fraught with folly, as some would say. But once it became clear that everyone was trying to work for the same goal, everyone was suffering the same issues, nobody could buy anything, you know, people didn't have any money and lived in the richest nation on the planet. So they decided they were going to get past mostly their racial issues and deal as one group of people with one goal in mind.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. We'll go now to the phones again. We're going to take a call. The number is 800-933-5372. Let's hear from Linda in Dallas. Linda, go ahead.
Hey, good afternoon, Courtney. And Allison, I look forward to reading your Smithsonian article. My question for you and other listeners, particularly in Texas, is what other groups are planning to do along with those of us who are already involved in the follow-up from Reverend William J. Barber's second visit to Dallas and other areas in January. We had a 4-hour training at Agape AME Church. We've had presentations at Temple Emmanuel, at the Dallas Institute of Culture and Humanities, and many others, and are working on organizing a host committee for Texas, as I'm sure others are doing across the country. So I'm really interested in plans for the 40 days of action from May 10th to June 21st, and then the nationwide rally on Saturday, June 22nd. Just interested in connecting up with what others are doing. It was our Thanksgiving Square Faith Forward Dallas and Interfaith Council among those who hosted him recently, and are just very excited about upcoming plans.
So it sounds like a lot happening locally across the country. What have you heard about that, Allison?
What I've heard so far is that they have been in several cities over the last week or so delivering letters at various state houses and talking about their platform. They are looking to, they say, shift what they call the distorted moral narrative from personal issues like prayer in school, abortion, sexuality, and gun rights to systemic injustices like how our society treats the poor, those on the margins, you know, that kind of thing. So they are looking to involve people in a nationwide movement to change this. I don't know all of the things that they've been talking about, but that's where they are right now. They're visiting various state houses in states, letting people know about this campaign, letting them know what's going on. And I know that they are planning a pretty big demonstration on the 23rd. They're expecting tens of thousands of people, and they're going to be demonstrating in front of the U.S. Capitol.
Something I was curious about. So as Resurrection City is kind of in full motion, we have thousands of people, some living in tents, little A-frame wooden structures with plastic sheeting, others living kind of nearby with friends and relatives. And this is happening, and there's music, and there's speeches, and there's a lot of attention, I'm sure, by media. What is white middle class and upper middle class America thinking? How are they reacting to this?
You know, I don't know the full answer to that. The few people that I spoke to that showed up at the press conference and a couple of folk I spoke to that lived in the area at the time said their whole attitude was, what are all those people doing there? Mm-hmm. You know, and why do we care about what they're doing there? But some of them actually got involved. They walked over and talked to some of the people in the tents. They walked over and listened to some of the speeches and then said, wow, maybe there's something that we can do about this. Some of them said they contributed money. Some of them said they just came to be there in solidarity and then went back to their homes on Capitol Hill or wherever. But, you know, I think I got a 50-50 split on what people were thinking about it. Because they said, oh, okay, those are poor people. And wow, they're poor people of all those different colors. They thought that was interesting. But I'm not sure that it resonated with people in this city that this was something that they needed to be a part of.
Do you think the message at least kind of permeated the social conscience? Do you think that America had a better idea of what poverty looked like after Resurrection City packed up and moved on?
I think it absolutely did, but I'm not sure how long that message lasted. Because I must say, I grew up in Chicago, and I didn't really know about Resurrection City until a couple of years ago. I've only been in D.C. for a few years, and I did not know about it because it wasn't something that we were taught in school. So if it's not something, I mean, of course I knew about the March on Washington, but I didn't know about the Poor People's Campaign because, as Dr. Bunch said, it's one of King's principles that people often overlook, his continuing battles for economic justice. So I think it made television, people saw it, people were amazed by it, but I'm not sure that that message stayed as in the way that they were hoping it would.
How do you think the organizers gauged the success? I mean, were they happy with at least how it unfolded, or did they wish they had done it differently?
I think they didn't wish they had done it differently. They were happy with the way it unfolded, although depending upon who you talk to, when the Resurrection City was shut down in June, some say that that was orchestrated, some say that it wasn't orchestrated, and they didn't know because basically what happened was they had a permit allowing them to stay until June 23rd, and then on June 24th, they came in with bulldozers and basically took the city down. People were running to save posters and, you know, placards that had been there and that sort of thing. Some people say that they were aware that that was going to happen, so they stayed to get arrested because of the optics, right? Mm-hmm. But other people said that they really didn't know that that was going on, so they were frightened and terrified. You know, I think what many of the organizers are saying is their battle is not over.
Our guest this hour is Allison Keyes. Her piece in Smithsonian Magazine is called Deeply Grieving MLK's Death, Activists Shaped a Campaign of Hurt and Hope. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Call 800-933-5372 to join the conversation.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. Our guest this hour is Allison Keyes, who wrote a piece for Smithsonian Magazine titled Deeply Grieving MLK's Death, Activists Shaped a Campaign of Hurt and Hope. So, Allison, tell us about the Smithsonian exhibit, what it chronicles and what you get to see there.
When you walk into the exhibit, you're in mood lighting almost, right? It's set up like an art exhibit so that you see all of these beautiful placards and lapel buttons and actual pieces from inside the tents that are set up all around the room. There's a huge panel from inside of one of the tents that's painted with a large red peace sign. It's filled in with yellow, and it's next to a blue-green symbol that looks kind of like an Asian dragon. There's the sheet music and lyrics from Jimmy Collier and Reverend Frederick Douglass Kirkpatrick, who I spoke about before. You hear recordings of the people singing there. There's a series of pictures all throughout where you see what's happening with the children being educated, where you see people actually putting the tents together. You know, there's also a feature film that shows how the segment was built. It's film that actually was never seen before by the Hearst Corporation. And this is 3,500 people we're talking about that are building this. So You see people with wagons full of wood, right? And, you know, they're sitting and putting together these A-frames. It's really pretty interesting.
And the exhibit is called City of Hope, Resurrection City in the 1968 Poor People's Campaign. It was organized by the one museum and put on by the other. Was it the National
right.
Museum of African
History? The National Museum of African American History and Culture mm-hmm. organized it, and it's on view at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. Oh, I should add, they also have interviews with some of the people that organized it. There's like a capsule interview with Marion Wright Edelman and with Peter Edelman and with some of the other organizers of the campaign talking about what they went through and how they were able to make this happen. But if you don't mind, I actually wanted to go back to another point earlier because she asked about what some of the things the current campaign is doing.
Yeah, please.
So what they say is that they are trying very hard to focus at the state and local level. They don't want to talk to Democrats or Republicans. They don't want to talk to left or right. They want to do this in a nonpartisan way because they say some of the most regressive policies are being passed at the state level, and these policies will have a long and lasting effect. You know, the movement, they say, is not from above but below. They're planning to do a season of sustained nonviolent civil disobedience as a way to, quote, break through the tweets, I should say, and shift the moral narrative. So it'll be interesting to see what else they come up with.
And I'm guessing, I mean, a lot of people that are listening right now wouldn't have had the opportunity to experience Resurrection City in any way. After you go through the exhibit, do you really get a sense of what it was like to be there?
Well, I don't think you would get a sense completely of what it was like to be there, but there is footage that's focused on a covered wagon, which, you know, like one of the wagon trains, mm-hmm. and it's kind of cool to see footage of the mule train on the actual wagon train. There's a tent that you can be inside that has some of the pictures and videos that were taken that day. But it gives you a sense of what people were thinking. It gives you a sense of what people were feeling. But no, I wouldn't say that you feel like you're sitting in the middle of it. But it does make you think about what people went through.
What did you learn about what it took logistically to make it happen? Obviously, we talked a lot about the ideology behind the construction of Resurrection City, people coming from all different corners of the country, people of different races kind of unifying for one of the first times toward a common goal. But at the end of the day, like you said, there had to be a daycare, there had to be places for children to be educated, there had to be bathrooms, they had to put up these A-frame houses, feed people, set it up and tear it down. Did that take a lot of logistical and organizational work?
It actually did. There was an architect that came up with the design for the A-frame houses. And there were people that were in charge of all of those things because, as I said, we're talking 3,500 people. So it wasn't like, you know, you had your own kitchens and your tents, right?
Right.
So, yes, there was a lot of logistical support. And, of course, there was also the battles of trying to keep some people that might have wanted to do something more radical than the nonviolent protests that everyone had agreed to keep them in check so that they didn't go off and do something crazy and cause a bunch of other drama. But they protested in front of the Department of Justice. They protested in front of the Capitol. So there were things going on the whole time. And yes, it was kind of a logistical nightmare from what people told me. But they said it was really wonderful to be there because you felt so much that you were part of something. You felt so much that you were part of a movement and part of a community in a way that you didn't feel if you were just sitting at home watching somebody march on television.
Now, obviously, the 50th anniversary of the movement is a big reason for an exhibit, for an article. But as we kind of alluded to before, earlier in the show, I mean, do you think there are some other parallels between 1968 and 2018, aside from the milestone anniversary, that really make what was happening then relevant now?
Oh, absolutely. You know, everyone I talk to, pretty much for every story I've been working on lately, it talks about how the racial divide in the nation now is almost worse than it's been since the civil rights movement. So this is a time where people are trying to figure out how to fix that. They're trying to figure out what to say about that. They're trying to figure out how to talk to lawmakers that are so divided by down partisan lines that you can hardly get anything done. And you're trying to talk so that a president who is tweeting necessarily, you know, or who is tweeting constantly might hear what you have to say and might think that you want to do something about it. The nation is so divided right now. I think people are really worried, and they're using this 50th anniversary, as Reverend Dr. Barber said, not as a commemoration, but as a continuation of what needs to be done to fix the ongoing problems of poverty, because it's not getting any better. There are fewer people with houses. There are fewer people that are able to buy things. I mean, even people with jobs can't buy things in the cities, right? I mean, if you live in Washington, D.C., a one-bedroom apartment in some neighborhoods can cost you up to $500,000. Who has that money lying around? right? So if you have a family of four and you're making $41,000 a year to feed your whole family, then how are you going to save any money? How are you going to leave anything for your children? How are you going to make it possible for them to go forward? You have no house to give them. You might not have a car to give them, right? And then you have all the movement back and forth between the cities and suburbs. So I think a lot of people think that this is an ongoing and worsening problem and something new needs to be done. And a lot of them, I think, well, the Poor People's Campaign say that they have hope, but a lot of people that I've spoken to at demonstrations recently don't have any hope. They're just demoralized and sad and scared.
Let's take a call now. The number is 800-933-5372. Let's hear from Hamza in Plano. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. My question is the Poor People's Campaign involved in the election process at all? And do they have certain candidates that they endorse for the election in November? Thank you.
Go ahead.
No, they said they absolutely aren't supporting any elected officials because they want to get their work done in a nonpartisan way. They say they're not supporting Democrats, they're not supporting Republicans, they're not on the left or on the right. This, for them, is about this battle for poverty. It's the battle against racism. It's the battle against economic injustice. And they aren't going to support candidates because they would rather try and get people to deal with these issues. Yes, they want legislators to support them, but they said they will not have any elected officials or candidates get on stage or serve on their organizing committee or anything like that.
Tell me a little bit about what you started to mention earlier. Obviously, ideologically, the movement behind the Poor People's Campaign Resurrection City stressed nonviolence. We talked about how logistically it was difficult to keep a city functioning outside in the National Mall for 6 weeks in the spring of 1968. How tough was it to kind of keep that nonviolent message in check? I mean, were there any incidents? Were there outbursts? Was there violence? Or was it well-respected across the board?
From what I have heard, it was well-respected across the board. I know, some gang members that came from different cities. There were some white gang members, I believe, that came from Chicago. There were obviously Black Panthers here, and there were some radical people. But from what I've heard, everything mostly stayed pretty calm. There may have been some incidents that I'm not aware of, and I'm sure that there might have had to be some severe talking to some people, right? But from what I understand, this mostly stayed calm because people were trying to send a unified message.
And does that surprise you, given, I mean, kind of the nature of some of our most recent peaceful protests that have had, you know, uprisings and outbursts kind of buried within them? I mean, is it interesting to you that in 1968, when this was kind of a new idea, that it was able to go as smoothly as it did?
I do think it's interesting, but I also remember that is a time where Dr. King was already leading nonviolent marches, right, where people were being attacked by dogs and fire hoses and did not fight back in most cases, right? So with that already on your television, with that already in your head, and with it being said to you, listen, we're going to do this and we're going to do it nonviolently because if we do it with violence, they're not going to hear us. But if we just come and stand here and make you look at our faces, if we come and stand here and make you look at our children and don't fight you, but tell you what we're thinking and tell you what we need, then perhaps our message will have more power.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. So, Allison, you covered Barack Obama's inauguration for NPR on the same ground where Resurrection City had been built at that time 40 years ago, 50 years ago today. Did the scenes you saw then, especially the record crowd in 2008, shape how you saw the Smithsonian exhibit and how you saw that research you did for your piece?
Yeah, a little bit, because the thing I have to say about being there in 2008 was the level of people was simply mind-blowing. My parents came from Chicago and stayed with me for 5 days. And I spent some time on the mall and I spent some time in U Street talking to people around, but you could not move through that crowd. I had never seen so many smiling people of all races all over the place. My parents couldn't get any closer than the Washington Monument because there were people packed all the way back there. So to think of that in your mind's eye and then think of a city of poor people being there, yeah, it's really something. And even though the crowd was a little bit smaller for his next inauguration, still, the National Mall is a place where people come and say things they have to say to the government, you know? So I think it's kind of great that Resurrection City was there, and that's where you have inaugurations. That's where you have so many demonstrations. That's where you had the 1963 March for Jobs and Freedom. You know, it's the nation's doorstep, and that's where you come to say what you have to say.
What do you think was most misunderstood about poverty in 1968 when this was going on? What did the outsiders looking in not understand about how poor America was living?
I think the same thing that people misunderstand about poverty now, because what you hear from people when you talk about the problem of poverty, they're like, well, why don't they get jobs? What makes you think there are jobs? Well, why aren't they working? Why aren't they doing this? Well, and in 1968, as I said, poverty looked different. People had jobs. There were manufacturing jobs. There were auto workers' jobs. Those people were able to buy houses, but still were barely able to keep food on the table. These days, you can't own anything because almost the minimum wage is impossible for people to live on, right? So I think a lot of people don't understand that there are people out there that have 2 and 3 jobs that are doing whatever they can to support their families, then as now, in some cases. And if you are a person that makes $300,000 a year, you don't understand that. If you're a person walking into a restaurant and spending $20 on a glass of wine and watching this on television, you don't understand that because you think, oh, there's something else that could be different. But then you walk into McDonald's and you see senior citizens behind the counters where there used to be teenagers. So things are clearly different.
Tell me a little bit about what you started to mention earlier, kind of the two-pronged approach to fighting poverty in the 60s and then kind of the single-pronged approach today. What is the biggest difference between how the issue was approached then versus now?
Lonnie Bunch at the museum said, originally in 1968 when the Poor People's Campaign happened, there was a two-pronged approach where you were doing social programs, you were doing Head Start, you were doing welfare, you were giving people a helping hand, a net to fall back into, a safety net. Sorry, was the word I was looking for.
I gotcha.
And there was also, I know, right? And there was also, you know, the hand that was stimulating the economy to try and keep this going. But he thinks now, in 2018, the commitment to that social safety net is gone because, you know, the current tax plan doesn't support a lot of that. So if you're going to stimulate the economy on one thing, I mean, you've got all these companies saying, oh, we're going to give these people a $1,000 bonus, or these people are going to get another $1.50 a week. But if you have no safety net for the people that fall through those cracks, then you're still going to lose a whole lot of people. So again, it's a different problem now than it was in 1968, but it's a huge problem.
Why do you think that changed? Why do you think the emphasis on the social safety net component faded over time?
Well, if you listen to the Republican leadership and to the president, those programs weren't working. They say that they weren't being used by a lot of people, and therefore that money should be used for the military and things like that, which isn't necessarily true, arguably, depending upon if you talk to social activists in the neighborhoods or if you talk to somebody at a poor hospital or somebody at a community center in Washington, D.C. that's lost all their funding. You know, it depends on which side of the coin you look at. But the government is not being as supportive of those programs as it had been before, and a lot more people are falling through the cracks.
We just have a few seconds left. What is the one thing you'll take away from all this research you did that you'll remember going forward?
That poverty is different today. It's still a problem. And whatever, something needs to be done. I mean, something needs to be done. And again, I'm a journalist here, so I'm not going to say, I can't say what can be done. But there are still a lot of people living in what Bunch called the pain of poverty. And the nation ought to find a way to fix it.
Our guest this hour was Allison Keyes. Her article in Smithsonian Magazine is called Deeply Grieving MLK's Death, Activists Shaped a Campaign of Hurt and Hope. Allison, thank you so much for your time. It's been a very interesting conversation.
You're welcome.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. Once again, I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.